I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Nerdy Show Book Club. Ah, hello, I am, Bookman, Cap, and with me are my compatriots, all librarians.
Yes, I am the ever-literary Hex.
Oh, now I'm gonna be put on the fucking spot. I don't...
I used to be a volunteer librarian, Luke.
Ah, fancy man.
I am Brandon. I don't know what's going on.
And I'm Colin.
Can I be Sir? Can I be Sir Brandon?
Nope, you had your chance.
Of Welshire.
You had
sir, Welshire.
You farms. Had your chance, good sir.
Yeah, to take it on a tangent already. If Cap could back me up on this, I remember when we would volunteer. Speaking of volunteering at the Renaissance Festival in Deerfield Beach, Florida, we used to be Joust Boys.
Yes.
And when we were Joust Boys, what your job was to get the crowd like all riled
was to
up
take
and stuff
the
like
lance.
That.
All yes. of it.
Yes. And so if you got the crowd riled up, you would get a possible double dehorsing where the mm-hmm. where you know both of the horses, the knights would get thrown off of the horses if you got the crowd like all freaked out, and then the horses would get freaked out. It was awesome.
Wait, you mean sure. it was staged?
No,
it like the
no,
horses
no, it
would freak
staged.
Out.
I thought the better the crowd was doing, they'd be like, okay, well, let's give them a show.
If the crowd freaks out, the horses are more likely to freak out, and if the horses freak out and they go faster, then the chances of something really fucked up happening on the field.
Why would they want you to do that?
Increased because
that is
the better
the greatest
show.
Job I've ever heard of.
Anyway, all of that was because my name was Sir Thomas of Muffin.
Well. You sure can tell a story in a roundabout way. Anyway, you may have noticed that we actually came in on a theme song. How was that, right? Really cool, eh? Yes.
I hope so.
I'm nodding in affirmation.
Do we have a chiptune rendition of the Reading Rainbow theme song? This is a classic
It's by 8-Bit Betty, who is now defunct, but still, this the song is her legacy. It is a phenomenal track.
Haha. Well met. All right, guys. So we are really excited to be debuting the first full episode of Nerdy Show Book Club. As you may know, Nerdy Show Book Club was a microsode in the past. It was a listener-submitted microsode from Joe Barta, who said, hey, talk about what books you're reading right now. And we said, sure. And we all liked it, and you all liked it, and so now it's a regular deal.
Yay!
Thanks, Joe Barta.
I mean, it works out because I think we were all going to read at least another book within the next year anyway.
It happens.
So.
Well, it's supposed to be monthly, Brandon. We're supposed to read a book.
What? How do you finish a book in a month? It takes me like 2 years to finish one book. You know how many books I've read in my life?
5.
Like 10.
The Stand and War and Peace.
2 years each.
The Stand and War and Peace.
I think I have a hunch that Brandon will answer his own question.
I don't read any books that there are movies of.
Well, that's a good thing that we've added in a segment later on in this episode where we read excerpts from film adaptations. And Luke has a real treat in store for you. But
I got a weird one. It's going to be great.
This particular debut episode, because I guess the other one could be considered an episode zero, just a precursor, is actually double length because we have a special feature. By surprise.
Surprise to me.
Yeah.
Surprise!
We found out about an amazing literary project.
Amazing!
It's called Singularity & Co., and it is a project to resurrect long-forgotten, dusty, musty sci-fi books from the dead and publish them digitally.
But don't take our word for it.
With us on the line is Ash Kalb, and in the background, Miss CC James.
Hello.
Error
the dog.
It's already spiraling into pandemonium. Perfect. Ash and Cece are together, Singularity & Co. They are, I guess you're becoming a company that is going to release and distribute eclectic sci-fi novels that will never otherwise see distribution in the digital format.
Yeah, that's correct. We're something akin to a publishing house. We're figuring out, but we really didn't have a label when we started the project. We just realized there were a lot of great books that we'd like to help get online.
Yeah, that's something that I can really get into. I can really back that up, and I've done so with my money via your extremely successful Kickstarter campaign.
Thank you.
Tell us how you developed this project and really what you're hoping to accomplish with it. I mean, it's obviously here on Nerdy Show, sci-fi, especially like eclectic off-the-beaten-path sci-fi, is something that we can really relate to and really dig. So I want to know how you guys got this started. It's fantastic.
Well, you know, we were basically sitting around one night, and I was trying to find a book to read on my Kindle, and I was noticing how many really bad old sci-fi books there are on Kindle, but how the selection is clearly not in any way comprehensive. So it kind of got me thinking about what it is that makes some books available and some books not available. You know, within about half an hour or so, we kind of talked the idea through and come up with the idea of finding a way to rescue some of these books that are otherwise going to be forgotten if they're not turned into ebooks somehow. And that's where the Kickstarter was born.
I agree with this because half of the time I turn on my Kindle and I'm trying to look for a really good sci-fi book or novel and I can't find anything that I really give a shit about. And then you guys are doing this and that's amazing. And soon I'll have great stuff to read, hopefully, on my Kindle.
Well, you know, it's going to be great. Some of it will be less than great. But it's all going to be exemplary of the period in which it was written. That's our main goal.
Excellent.
I mean, we're going to choose what we think is great, whether or not you think is great, we're not sure. But you know, we're looking for works that are really they stand out as being about what sci-fi was about at the time when they were written. If that sentence makes any sense.
Have you found these books already? Do you have them in your collection? How do you have such a vast knowledge of all of these sci-fi books to put?
Particularly eclectic ones.
Deciding to do this empowered me immediately before we'd even realized we were going to do a Kickstarter to go out and buy massive quantities of books on eBay, which is where we started. Hmm. So I started bidding on very large, obscure lots of old sci-fi books, often without knowing what was in them. And they started showing up here at our apartment and basically taking over a very large corner of it. That's where we started. Where we've gone from there is to start cataloging all the books that we have, and we're doing that by just simply photographing them, entering them into a database program, and then kind of reaching out to the people that we know to see what they think of the titles that we have available. And one really great resource is a guy named Bud Webster, who's actually the estates liaison for the SFWA, which is the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Association. He's tasked with maintaining a database and contact information for the estates of sci-fi writers who have passed away. So he actually knows how to get in contact with a lot of the people who we're looking for. And he also has a lot of knowledge of the history of the industry and kind of has given us some invaluable guidance as to what's good and what's bad. There's also a lot of other people that have chimed in. We even got one of our very first suggestions from Neil Gaiman, who suggests his favorite bad sci-fi book on Twitter. But it was a great way for us to get started, because if people keep chiming in and telling us what to look for, it helps.
That's awesome. You can't really beat an endorsement from Neil Gaiman, can you?
No, we had Duncan Jones call our project cool. We had Neil Gaiman, an early supporter. Ken McLeod has also been incredibly helpful. Plus, a number of other sci-fi authors have really reached out and understood what the project is all about.
That's really exciting to have that much support. Just a random idea that's been seems to be spiraling in a great project.
It's now becoming your life.
It's definitely becoming a large portion of our lives, but you know, if this ends up being what we do for the next couple of years, I'm certainly not complaining.
It's really great that you're doing this, because it really takes a loving hand to usher things out of obscurity back into the limelight. I think that everyone who's on board with this project really sees it for what it is.
You know, it also actually takes quite a bit of manual labor, we're figuring out, which is not something you think of when creating ebooks, but these books actually have to be scanned, you know, a photographed catalog. It's a fascinating and all-encompassing project.
The way that we found out about you was one of our friends of Nerdy Show, who our listeners have maybe seen in some of the videos that we post during E3. Matt Downham is actually designing new cover art for your books. And I was curious about that project and what you have in mind for the covers.
Well, you know, it was really an incredible offer, and it's kind of exemplary of what's been going on ever since this idea kind of hit the internet, which is Matt reached out to us, actually in reference to that not-so-great book that Neil Gaiman suggested to us, which is a book called Space Train. And I can only describe the existing cover to Space Train for you. It's clearly really an incredible work of superimposed photography, because somebody clearly photographed the tip of their pen and a crab on a piece of glass and wrote the word Space Train on it. And that's the cover that currently exists for the book. While there's a lot of great sci-fi cover art out there, and we want to preserve as much of it as possible, what we thought we'd do, what Matt suggested, is also doing modern takes on the covers, or modern retro takes on the covers, and adding something new to them. And what we'd eventually like to do is actually get more people involved and let as many people as would like contribute covers to be voted on for the project, but that's a little bit down the road.
That's very cool. Because I was wondering, one of your most recent updates featured a ton of great cover scans of stuff, and I was like, well, that's really cool that there'll be, you know, new covers, but these old ones are so good.
We're going to hold on to the old ones as much as humanly possible. Some of the older works don't have covers like the ones that you saw in the latest update,
mm-hmm.
So we'll be supplementing them with newer ones, but where the old covers still exist, they'll still be there. It may just be, in effect, a front cover and a back cover.
Now, for listeners who are hearing this, just as we post this episode, there's actually still time to get in on the Kickstarter. At this point, it's all going over and well past your goal. But the thing that over 600 people have chipped in on is the $25 donation, which gets you a lifetime subscription to your digital books, which is incredible. I think that in a large part, the success of the Kickstarter can chalk it up to that deal being too good to pass up.
We hope it is. You know, we're going to be releasing the books on a number of platforms as we clear them and turn them into ebooks. But we thought this is a great way for people who support us early to reap the benefits of that. And that's the really incredible thing about Kickstarter. It's we've already achieved financial success for the project. And success, I mean, we've managed to pay for the expenses at least. And that way we're able to make that commitment to people. It's a really incredible way to be able to start something.
Now that you've gone over, though, what are your plans for the extended, budget you've got now?
Well, what the extra budget really helps us do is it helps us speed up. You know, you can throw time at this or you can throw money at it when you're trying to clear a book. Each book that we try to clear is in effect a detective story. We have to go and we have to track down the authors, their estates, their third cousin twice removed occasionally.
Hmm.
And the reason we have to do that is because the books that have clear titles and ownership, well, they're taken care of already. If the author is successful, their catalog is being looked after. but for an author who maybe wrote a few books in the 50s, didn't get treated very well by their publisher, and then, you know, forgot about it, that's the person that we're looking for. Those are the books that we're looking to rescue. And because of that, there's a lot of research involved, there's a lot of time involved, there's also filing costs associated with clearing the copyrights and all of that. An additional budget basically means that we're secure for the first year of books, and in addition, we can do things more quickly.
Now, you have, it's on your most recent update, you say that you've reached nearly 240% of your original funding goal with over, I mean, obviously you have over 900 backers, but if you reach over $45,000, because right now, currently as of this recording, you have $36,000-some-odd, what will happen at $45,000 if people back it to that point?
You know, we've been crunching numbers. We've actually gone through the process of creating a couple of e-books from old books already, and we're very confident that if we reach the $45,000 goal that we've added today, that we'll be able to deliver not 12 books in the first 12 months, but 18 books in the first 12 months. I'm hesitant to say, you know, I'm hesitant to give an exact schedule for that, because it'll probably be more books towards the end, but we're definitely willing to make that additional commitment, and the people who become $10 supporters will get 18 books instead of 12, and the people who become $25 supporters will get more books more quickly. It's very exciting. You know, it's all a vote of confidence and of support for the entire project.
It's incredible.
Yeah, that is really exciting. I was wondering, something you've mentioned in the updates, I believe you're saying that there's a Singularity & Company shop opening up, like a real-world storefront?
Well, that's kind of where this whole thing began. TC and I have often talked about what our ideal work environment is, and the goal was always to open a bookshop. We've been talking about opening a bookshop for a very long time, and the key to our ability to open a bookshop is that it doesn't have to actually pay its own rent, because we both run successful businesses from our current office. So our plan is to move our office to Dumbo, open an actual storefront sci-fi bookshop, which will be New York's only dedicated sci-fi bookshop, and kind of create a destination for all of the people and the community that supported this project so much.
Wow. How many dedicated sci-fi bookshops in the world are there to begin with?
We know of one in San Francisco. You know, there's Forbidden Planet here in New York, which is a great comic book shop, but they've only got two shelves of sci-fi books.
Not nearly the same as an entire shop, no.
But the trick here being that I doubt a sci-fi bookshop could actually sustain itself financially.
Right.
But if we're already paying the rent on an office, it might as well be a bookshop too.
Yeah, that's very cool. I mean, especially when you're investing in the digital age and you're investing in the new mediums, but then also you have a storefront bookshop. As a big fan of musty pages and strange bookstores go, like, I like that you can play both, you know, sides on that. That's very cool.
Yeah, we actually haven't had anybody go for what I think is the coolest reward in this Kickstarter campaign, which is at the highest pledge level, we'll actually give somebody a key to the bookshop and they can, you know, treat it as their own. But we've had a number of people go for what we've offered in kind of the middle between ebooks and owning the bookshop with us, which we've offered lending library privileges in the bookshop, and there's a couple of people that have gone for that. So they'll be able to come in and yank the bookshop books off the shelves at will, as long as they promise to bring them back.
Wow. Do you have an idea of, I mean, you said that you were tentative, but do you have any idea as to when do you think you'll release your first ebook?
I guess it'll be within 45 to 60 days, probably faster. We've gone all the way down the road on two books already, but I'm still working on clearing those books. They'll probably show up a little bit later in the rotation. On the flip side, there are a couple of books that we know we can publish, but we haven't actually scanned them yet. There's some infrastructure stuff that we have to do, like actually create a website that's capable of delivering this stuff to all of our subscribers also.
Right.
But we've got some people working on that with us, so I'm guessing 45 to 60 days.
Are you in any kind of position to reveal what some of your first titles will be, or has that not been signed off on yet?
I'll be in a position later this week to post a list from which the first titles will come, which I know isn't a great answer, but I'll tell you what I've done so far, which is get really, really, really excited about a book and then realize it's already available. So the first thing I got to do is actually vet a list of books that need our help.
Okay, so by the time you guys listen to this, we should hopefully have a link to where you can see the list of the first tentative books to be released.
And what that'll be is that'll be the list that our users will be able to vote up or down in our polling system for earlier e-booking treatment.
Very cool. Very, very cool. One last question. I was wondering if you recall the first sci-fi book you ever read.
You know, wow. It was probably one of the Heinlein juveniles because my dad had them on a shelf growing up, and those are kind of like boy life type books.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to be able to tell you it's Rocket Ship Galileo, but the first sci-fi book that like I really loved was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if that helps.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. It's a very good starting point.
It definitely wired my brain the way that it's wired, without a doubt.
Awesome. So before we go, when is the Kickstarter completed, essentially?
There are just under 5 days to go. The deadline is around 4 p.m. on the 2nd of next month.
April 2nd, 2012, around 4 p.m. Eastern. That's your last chance to invest in this incredible project and to get yourself a lifetime subscription to amazing, eclectic digital copies of science fiction novels for life. Or more.
You'll be able to get them otherwise, but you probably won't be able to get a deal this good.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly that. Well, thanks so much, Ash.
It's really my pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this project.
Well, we really are just blown away by the support that we've received from the community and by the number of people that just understand how fundamentally good an idea this is. You know, the great tragedy is that a lot of these books contain a concept like an ebook, and yet without a project like this, they'll never be ebooks.
That's actually funny.
We appreciate all the support.
So remember, guys, if you're hearing this concurrent with this episode's original posting, you've got a few days to get in on that lifetime subscription plan. And if not, then you can head over to Singularity & Co.'s website and pick up any of their amazing digital reproductions from now until forever.
But we'll have a link to the Kickstarter on this episode's page.
Well, I have a link to everything.
Also, on a side note, I have a freezer full of reproductions. Just letting you know that. And anyone can come by and pick them up, because they're taking up space in our freezer. You know what I'm talking about, Hex and Cap.
Yes,
and possibly Colin. Luke doesn't know, though.
I never went in the fridge, and thank God.
I don't really know what your sperm collection has to do with this particular episode, but
the word reproduction, it sets me off. Anyway.
Okay.
Oh, he's got to go make another deposit in the refrigerator. Hold on.
I'm starting my own sperm bank, and therefore I need to do a Kickstarter as well.
Oh my gosh.
It's called There's Not Enough of Me.
I'm sure my freezer's cold enough. Anyway.
Oh my gosh.
So, Hex, you got a song?
I do. So, since that, the whole Singularity & Co. project is all about forgotten science fiction, I wanted to bring in a song that's about almost forgotten science. There's this poor little thing that used to be a planet that isn't anymore.
Did it get turned into a Kuiper Belt object?
Yes. Well, not a Kuiper Belt. Is it a Kuiper Belt object?
Uh-huh.
Oh, poor Pluto.
Wait, no. I know what you guys are about to talk about, but you're talking about Pluto, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, guess what?
What?
Pluto is the first.
Oh, God.
Of the Plutoids.
Oh, no. Yeah, the...
Wait, what? What the hell is a Plutoid?
It's actually... The technical term is a dwarf planet. It's not an object of the Kuiper Belt.
So it's a planet again.
No, it's but a it's dwarf a planet.
It's a dwarf... What the hell does that mean? It still has planet in the title.
Snow White's going to get her dumbass lost over there. Go hang out on the dwarf planet.
Well, the thing is, they were finding other Pluto-sized objects over there, and they're starting to go, well, are they all going to have to be...
They're called asteroids. They're frozen balls of shit in space, of dirt and liquids, and then they go everywhere.
No, it's a trans-Neptunian dwarf planet, so anything that's a trans-Neptunian dwarf planet has been named after Pluto.
So now everything, there's going to be more than one Pluto, basically.
So they're Plutoids, eh?
Plutoids, yes.
Plutoids.
Well, anyways, the track is for Pluto.
Okay.
And it's by Adam Warrock, our good pal.
Well, I'll just have to take his word for it.
Thank you. the little kid that ran around the block, and still underneath the skin was made of ice and rock. Cause it's a cold universe, and I don't see the sun as much, living on the outskirts of town where I grew up. And I never really made a sound, all the kids would play around, though they stayed as quiet as they spun around like tops. And we lived in darkness and plotted out a course, and we dreamed like satellites with centripetal force. And I was never really sure why I didn't fit in, thought maybe it's my size or the color of my skin. And it transposed itself to my caliber within, and I felt like I was all alone, just drifting in the dark. But stars and proximity told me to stop, even though I knew that I was just a chunk of rock with a little hip-hop mixed with punk rock. Baby, I can be your planet or whatever you want. And when the sun goes down, it's my turn to shine. Stay in the dark, baby, turn out the lights. Cause when we close together, just you and I, sometimes your eyes look like the night line. And I drift towards the heaven where the stars reside. Sometimes I know I got my head in the sky, with both feet on the ground, cause I'm telling you why. You're saying that there's eight, but I'm saying there's nine. And the scientific research didn't tell a lie when they redefined your soul and they took away your pride. But they couldn't change your name or do a damn thing. And still I see you shine when I look in the sky. And I know nights are dark when you feel all alone. And I know the way your heart feels so far from home. So far unknown when you're stuck in the cold. But you still reflect the sun steady doing your toll. Yeah. Good soldier, nights will get colder. Cats will stay sober, get the cold shoulder. And you don't need a label, do your own promotion. People see a glimmer like wherever you go. So just be glad that someone on earth holds a vigil. And everyone who's saying otherwise, stay civil. Cause they don't know the places and the things that you've seen. So float past the path, keep doing your thing. And when the sun goes down, it's my turn to shine. Stay in the dark, baby, turn out the lights. Cause when we close together, just you and I, sometimes your eyes look like the night line. And I drift towards the heaven where the stars reside. Sometimes I know I got my head in the sky, both feet on the ground, cause I'm telling you why. You're saying that there's eight, but I'm saying there's nine. Yo, I walk the streets of a city with its better days, passing by a man with his history spread across his face. Just like the cracks in the pavements, no one's safe in the system. Still I listen, cause the station's just a mile away. There's people coming and going straight with no direction, like ships lost in a fog off, and we all scream for attention. But here I am, just a stranger in a crowd in my home. Still so familiar, but now I'm unknown. I've seen buildings simply start from dust, broke the ground and built it up. Decades watched the dirt and rust, one day watched it boarded up. And now they tear it down so they can start all over again, until the old timers point and say, remember when? I pass a buck or two wondering if I'm stuck here too. Life patterns a cycle like soul samples that fell for loops. But still I promise you nothing is like the honest truth. Room is bittersweet in the streets, you call me Thomas Wolfe. So float on, Adam Warrock.
Well, welcome back from that scientific song. Since I asked Ash that question, I was wondering if maybe, and hopefully it's not too long an answer, but I was wondering if everybody else remembers the first sci-fi novel they ever read.
Oh, God.
Oh, geez. It's similar. The first true sci-fi novel I read was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well. Because it was very accessible, and it was available to me, and I could get it anywhere. So that's why.
Actually, the first science fiction novel that I read was actually by Isaac Asimov. It was called Norby the Mixed Up Robot.
Did he write a children's book?
He did. And it's actually a series.
Wow.
About this mixed up robot and how the adventures that he has with his, you know, companion and where they go and, you know, the various things that they go through. And that's by Isaac Asimov. And it's actually really good.
Well, I'll be fucked.
But don't take our word for it.
Oh damn it, it's not by Isaac Asimov, it's by Janet Asimov. Isaac Asimov, so they piled up on it.
Oh, they tag teamed it.
They did.
Okay, how about you, Luke?
And looking back, I believe my first sci-fi novel was a young adult book by Bruce Koval called Aliens Ate My Homework. That was surprisingly great. I thought it was great because it had the word damn in it at one point.
Scandalous!
But it's indeed about a group of tiny, tiny aliens who came to Earth, started using a kid's homework to make a little papier-mâché shelter for them. And then their little other tiny enemy comes and they have to fight him. And there was cool interdimensional stuff in there. I think I'm going to read it again.
I think I read that book. This sounds like a Pixar movie.
It could be a fantastic Pixar movie, and I hope they keep the word damn in it.
It's the only requirement.
Yes.
I remember reading a book series called My Teacher is an Alien, and then the second one was My Teacher Glows in the Dark.
You know, I remember seeing those books and going, no.
They were actually pretty good.
Were they?
Yeah.
Were they as good as Goosebumps? No, they weren't.
That's a hard, that's a high bar to put up, because Goosebumps was, like, really good.
Oh, yes.
I guess Goosebumps.
Oh, hold up. Really?
I love Goosebumps growing up. I love Goosebumps growing up.
Check this out. I read and bought with my own money, I believe, every single Goosebumps book from 1 to about 25 or so, maybe even 30.
I think I was there with you on that one.
Yeah. But there were only the first 5 were good. The rest were all garbage.
Oh, some of them were okay.
Good ones in there.
And really, it was just the first 3. 5 is me being generous.
Oh, come on. What about the giant hamster that, like, you know, takes over and, like, terrorizes that?
No, the giant hamster was pretty bad.
Oh. I like the one where he was in a comic book and he had to fight as a superhero.
That was a Sega game.
But don't take our word for it.
The coolest thing about the superhero one, which is called Attack of the Mutant, was that when they got around doing the Fox Kids television show, Adam West played that character in the episode.
Oh, wow.
How do you remember this?
No, wait a minute. Cap, you don't have anything like sitting in front of you that's able to, you know,
no,
tell you that
he is not. This is all off the top of his head.
Can you name all the Goosebumps books?
Absolutely not.
Oh. No, nobody can do that.
But the first 3 are Welcome to Dead House. Shit, I can't, you know what? I fucked up already. The second one was the plant one, and it was easily the coolest one.
Yeah, agreed.
But I cannot remember for life of me what it was called.
You know, I read those before the teacher book. Would those be? There's some of those have sci-fi elements.
They're not sci-fi though, really. They're not science fiction.
Yeah,
unless there was radiation involved. And there never was.
In fact, many of them are. I mean, they're really just. In most cases,
stupid.
Just weird, morbid fantasies more than anything. Yeah. And then the third one was Stay Cheese and Die. R.L. Stein wrote the first 3 kind of all at once as a project, didn't think he was going to do anymore, and they got really successful. So then,
and he was like, money!
I think the ghostwriting happened almost immediately. That's just a hunch, I don't know. But that could be why they're so fucking inconsistent.
His Twitter is pretty amusing, and he has the subtitle of I Scare Children for a Living.
So does Brandon.
You know, it's
but
funny,
don't take our word for it.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I read at least 1 or 2 Goosebumps books, and I didn't find them scary. I think I could write a great morbid children's story right now, even, and it would be great. It would be amazing.
I wish you would.
It would be my morbid fantasies.
I would love to read that.
I'm going to write a children's book.
Oh, Cap, you're wrong. Uh-oh. Stay Out of the Basement was the second one. Monster Blood was the third one.
Okay. Hold on a second.
Why are we having this discussion?
I know this is terrible. This was not supposed to happen. But I mean, that is just plain not true.
That's what Wikipedia said. Wikipedia said that Monster Blood comes out in September 1992. Say Cheese and Die came out in November.
You fucked up.
I don't know about the release dates, but the actual numbering of the books 1, 2, and 3, Welcome to Dead House, the one about the dad turning into a plant, and Say Cheese and Die 1, 2, and 3. I'm pretty sure.
Because then it's the Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, Let's Get Invisible, Night of the Living Dummy.
Oh, I like Night of the Living Dummy.
Can't Nightmare, The Girl Who Cried Monster, and The Ghost Next Door were the first 10. And then The Haunted Mask was 11. That was good, too.
Yeah, that was a really good one.
All right, so back on the sci-fi thing.
It's not just the top 5. Haunted Mask.
Who else hasn't gone? Everybody go? Except me?
Yeah, yeah. Go.
Okay. I guess the first sci-fi novel I started reading was the first Timothy Zahn Star Wars novel, I think. I'm not really sure about the coincidence of events, but I did not finish that as a kid. So I'd say the first thing I read on my own was A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle.
Ooh, I remember that. That was
which,
good.
Which, if you haven't read it as an adult, is fucking great. Just go ahead and read it. You'll get through it real quick, and you'll be like, God damn.
But don't take our word for it.
Let me ask you a question. Does The Magic School Bus count as science fiction? Because I may have read those way before Hitchhiker's Guide. Way before.
You know what?
Like, required in school.
Sure.
Okay. It's better than Goosebumps.
I will have to readdress my answer. It was Magic School Bus.
I mean, it's a bus, and sometimes they go into space, sometimes they go into the bloodstream.
Those are not novels.
You just said book. You didn't say novel.
Yeah, I mean, like, the first one I read. I mean, otherwise, yeah, it was going to be some Star Wars.
I may have said novel.
Well, if it was novel, then yes, Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, if it's novel, then it's probably one of the Star Wars knockoffs of, like, Tales from Jabba's Palace or something like that.
That was a good book.
That was a good one.
Shadow of the Empire.
I didn't read Shadow of the Empire.
All the Tales books. Tales of Jabba's Palace, Tales of the Cantina, Tales of the Bounty Hunters.
I love Tales of the Bounty. That's why Dengar's my favorite bounty hunter.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did we just have a bonding moment over Dengar?
Let's not spiral this into a Star Wars conversation, please.
So.
No, that book has the official where Boba Fett came from for me.
No. Boba Fett's a clone of some douchey looking guy.
Okay, shut up. Okay. We're moving on.
So what are we reading, Colin?
I guess I'm first. Well, what I read previously was the first book in the Wheel of Time series.
Ooh, I've been meaning to check that out.
Okay.
Is that the sequel to the Wheel of Fortune?
No.
Okay.
Here's the deal. Before you start it, this book, and it actually took me a really, really, really long time to read it because it was like around 700 pages long, was The Eye of the World. It was the Wheel of the Time. It was the first Wheel of Time book because my father-in-law gave it to me for Christmas a long time ago, and I figured I have to read it. So I'm reading it, and I'm like many, 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 many pages into it. So before you read it, Hex, let me give you my synopsis about the book without totally giving everything away.
Okay.
Basically, the way this book is, it's Robert Jordan wrote it.
Right.
And it's not finished yet. It's like there's 14 some odd books in this series, and it is like and it's not even finished. And the guys and Robert Jordan's dead.
Yeah, I remember being told back in high school by some of my close friends that I was supposed to read the series, and I still have yet to touch it.
Yeah. So I'm reading this book, and as I'm reading it, I'm a huge fan of Lord of the Rings. And as I'm reading this book, I'm going, wait a minute. What the shit? This book is an exact ripoff, basically, of The Lord of the Rings. I mean, this was written in 1990, this book. I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, I'm sure. But this book was written in 1990. You know, Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings significantly earlier than that. But basically,
just by a little bit.
Like about 100 years or so, just a couple years before.
Yeah. So basically, it's basically about this town. This town where these three... Well, actually, there's a bunch of kids are in this town, and
with a shire, so to speak.
Yes, a shire, so to speak, where these outsiders come in, and then decide that they need to then leave because they are possibly the chosen ones. They have these creatures called the Midrogrol.
We'll just call them Nazgul.
We'll just call them Nazgul. Who are chasing after them? They're basically like dark creatures who are on horseback.
Okay.
They are shrouded in black cloak.
They have swords.
And they are chasing after them. And they actually cross a river and the river ends up getting fucked up by magic.
Wow. Yeah, I've seen this movie.
I've seen this movie too.
It was Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, all sorts of this stuff kind of happens. You know, there's magic. They don't trust the people who have magic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They then end up having to go on this huge quest, and there's this dark power that's building in this place called the dark power lives in a place called Mount Doom. Mountains of Doom.
They just gave up.
Kidding.
They just gave up at that point.
Hex face palmed.
Mountains of Doom, but Doom is spelled Doom.
Okay, that's
different.
That's just pulling a Star Wars.
We represent legally distinct from...
And so, basically, they're trying to, you know, this chosen one, Rand, can basically, like, he has the power to... He can harness the power and basically magic and can defeat the bad guy who comes to visit him in his dreams, Beelzemon. And there's a Trolloc army. That Trollocs are the name of these,
so
like, basically orc creatures.
700 pages of blow-by-blow the plot structure of Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Go fuck yourself, Robert Jordan.
It's
why were my friends in high school so
really
obsessed with it?
Had they read Lord of the Rings?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I was friends with idiots in high school.
Is the language dumbed down? Like,
No. The language is good. I mean, it's relatively well written. The problem that I have with it is it's just that it so follows the formula of Lord of the Rings. I mean, it is the hero's journey, but it's just like it follows Lord. It borrows so many elements of Lord of the Rings that I just can't.
Mount Doom. You don't say. That's borrowing from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I would just rather read Lord of the Rings than this.
Yeah, and people rag on Willow for being too similar to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, no.
I haven't read the other books. You know, I don't know if I want to.
Let me know when you get to the Twin Towers.
Because it took me 2 months to read this book. I mean, it's 800 pages, you know, 700 pages. It took me a really long time to read it, and I don't know if I want to dedicate that much time to read that much more about this story. I mean, it's very interesting, but I would probably rather read the Cliff Notes.
Well, in the next one, they go into space, and there's an evil empire. And there's this giant space station that they have to blow up. So second one.
Called the Murder Star.
Yeah, it's the Murder Star.
Death Star.
Death Star.
And it's ran by this guy all in black named Darth Bad Guy. And he uses magic as well, but they call it the Force. The Farce. Yeah. Shut up.
But it's very, I mean, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in it. I mean, obviously, within 700 pages, you're going to have a very interesting world. But it's so similar.
I think you only find it interesting because you dedicated so much time to reading those pages that you just like, that's all you did. You knew about that world. So you found it interesting. But I don't think you really find it interesting.
Yeah, you're probably right. However, I do have to say, looking at this, there's never mind. I'm just reading like, because I was reminding myself on Wikipedia, and so like the world was created by an Aes Sedai who sacrificed themselves to create a pool of Sidin untouched by the Dark One's taint.
Okay. I want to see a world touched by the Dark One's taint over and over and over again. It can't smell good. Well, so, Colin, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'll give it a shrug.
I mean, it's a blatant copy. It's 100% blatant copy. They were just change a few things here and there.
It's not 100%. I'd say it's 76% bar.
here's my question: are the pages peppered with songs that really just kind of slow everything down?
You shut up. Those songs have purpose.
To make me take a nap.
Wow, if the musician is the one lamenting the songs, that says something. Wow.
I know you want to be a poet, JRR, but geez.
Because I know when I got to indent, I'm like, ooh, cool, time to skip 3 pages.
You don't want to hear about shipping the plates and...
Nope.
Okay, the Hobbit songs are a different story.
Yeah, the Hobbit songs are a different story.
Because the Hobbit does something that I think the Lord of the Rings never does, which is get to the point. Oh, yeah.
It's true.
I'll crap on Lord of the Rings. Let's
oh,
do
shit.
This.
We're getting serious. We got literary seriousness right here.
So I read The Wheel of Time, but don't take my word for it.
Okay, Brandon, what are you reading?
I am currently reading two books.
Two books.
Because I don't have much free time.
That looks like 8 books right there.
No, okay. book one is for when I have free time at work.
You're like already halfway through that.
There's, you know, you can see there's a demon on the front. You at home can't see it.
There's just a demon's face.
Well, on the side, it says Book of Cain. And you're like, oh, is this some biblical shit? No. No, this is the book written by Deckard Cain. From the Diablo series. I know what you're thinking. Badass, right? Okay, it's his journal. It's his accounts of all the shit he's been through. It's notes on enemies, places in Sanctuary. If you are a fan of Diablo, it is fucking badass. And it is badass, yep.
Oh, yep, and it's not just an art book. There are legitimate words on page there.
No, they're legitimate. Yeah, and you know I have trouble with words on pages.
And illuminated manuscripts.
Yeah, unless it's about birds, I have great difficulty reading words. Which brings me to the next book that I'm reading. Let me grab it. Hold on.
This is the other 7
it
books.
It weighs about 20 pounds.
Just plop it right here.
Whoa.
Okay.
You at home could feel that.
When I have some downtime at home, what I've been trying to read is this book called Avian Medicine, Principles and Applications. It's just 1,400 pages of good old-fashioned bird knowledge, good bird know-how. You know, you want to know why your bird's sick or his pooter's crusty? You can find out...
you can find out in this book. It tells you, you know, what's wrong with it, how to cure it, what the hell that cure is, how to pronounce it, what's that bacteria you just found coming out of his cooter. You don't know, but it'll tell you the name of it and what it looks like. You want to do surgery on your bird? It tells you step for step how to do that.
Or burgery.
Burgery. Burgery. It's got bird law. I mean, it's got everything you want. It's got...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, you want like it's like the code of Hammurabi.
Yeah. this is essentially a codex for bird knowledge. Look at all these pictures. You want to know what internal organs look
those
like
are
of birds?
Entrails.
Those are internal organs. You want to know what diseases look like for birds? Everything. When I say everything,
X-rays.
I mean fucking everything.
Yeah.
I'm gonna need you to send me a picture of the entry under Krusty Pooter.
That's a medical term, Krusty Pooter. You can Wikipedia
it.
I would
definitely be debuting the Brandon's new segment, Bird Knowledge with Brandon. or you just ask some bird questions and Brandon will answer it.
If you've ever wanted to learn about birds, this is a great book to read, but you don't have to take my word for it. I was smiling really poorly there. If you couldn't see it at home, but I'm getting old. I'm getting tired of this skit. Moving on.
Luke, what are you reading?
I am rereading my favorite fantasy-ish kind of sci-fi series called The Amber Chronicles by Roger Zelazny. And also just finished rereading his book Lord of Light, which is this awesome, sci-fi story told about it's the survivors of a ship had left Earth, had crashed on a planet, and the crew who had access to advanced technology turned themselves into a sort of parallels to the Hindu pantheon.
Oh.
And sort of develop their powers along those lines. So there's a Kubera and an Agni, Lord of Fire. And even if you don't know the Hindu pantheon, which I don't, it's really interesting. and it's written in this kind of archaic style in some of them, which is occasionally broken with very witty and cynical dialogue, which is typical to Zelazny. Oh, but the protagonist of Lord of Light is a man named Sam who has decided that because the gods, quote, have had sort of a totalitarian rule over everyone else who they keep in a medieval state, he started up Buddhism as a sort of way to foment revolution against them, and the story follows him.
Interesting. Wow, yeah, that's some complex plots. That sounds really super neat.
It's the first book I've heard today.
Actually,
that I like.
They put a bunch of short stories written in this world about this character together under one title, so it's not hard to follow when you read it. And it's a small – even though there's a lot of characters that get mentioned, the core set of characters is pretty small and you get used to them and they're really likable. It's hard not to like Zelazny characters, even though they're normally really flawed and kind of assholes.
I like them already.
Which is the main character of the Amber Chronicles, who is Corwin. Oh, geez. I don't even know how to explain the Amber Chronicles without spoilering. Well, it's
just
10
read,
books,
can
so
you
I can
read
spoil
the,
it in the first book.
Just read the back of the book, the little – you know, when they have a little thing on the back that describes it.
Okay, that would spoil it right there. Corwin is the prince of Amber, which is the one true city, and all other cities are reflections of it, which is basically it's Zelazny exploring multidimensionalism kind of thing.
Whoa.
Where all the royal family of this city of Amber can travel through what they call shadow, which by kind of – they imagine things and the world changes around them as they move. So they can go to anywhere that they can imagine. Corwin went to his own version of Avalon and hung out with King Arthur and such. And also some of them always seem to end up on our version of Earth, of course. And that's where you join Corwin. He has no memory. He wakes up in a mental hospital, fights his way out and talks his way out. And then you follow him putting his memory back together and then making a bid to control Amber.
That's pretty cool.
It sounds like I could read that.
Sounds pretty sweet. Oh, by the way, links to all the books we discuss in the link section for this episode. So if you want to check these out, click the link. It'll take you to the Amazon page. And, you know, for everything you buy, we get, like, pocket change.
Yay, hey, pocket change.
You know, if you're planning on getting it anyway, why the hell not, right?
Yay.
But sorry to interrupt, Luke. Is that basically the gist of it?
It is, but you don't have to take my word for it.
So I am reading by our good pal Brian Clevenger, The Traitor and the Monk. He just recently started up a website called superexplosive.com. And the point of that website is to put up prose, which is separate from all of his web comicry, so or actual comicry. So it's not really related to Atomic Robo or anything that's going on over at Nuclear Power, such as Warbot and Accounting or How I Killed Your Master. This is something completely different, and it is a interesting story that falls under the wuxie genre of books.
What does that mean?
That is martial arts stories, like the following the story of the kind of martial arts master, like Infinite Kung Fu would fall under wuxie. And so kind of Brian's, like, the author that inspired Brian to kind of want to experiment with this was Gu Long, who was a kind of renowned author. And so in this story, we just come across this character, this quote-unquote barbarian from the north named General Zhang Shen, who's picked up the title of traitor because he apparently abandoned his troops while attacking the Jin Palace and has since then been on the run. So there's bounty hunters chasing after him, and another main character, Most Observant Eagle, who is a Jin investigator, is on the search for them. And like with all characters in a wuxie story, they are all badasses in combat. Zhang Shen, pretty badass with a glaive. It's a pole arm with a...
Oh, we all know what a glaive is.
Not it.
And I, too, am sometimes a gin inspector.
Investigator.
Investigate. I investigate the hell out of my gin.
And Most Observant Eagle fights with this fishing rod that is just sitting there innocent as a fishing rod until he just, without even being able to see his movements, he changes it into a whip or a bow and arrow and unleashes hell upon any that oppose him. Zhang Shen runs across Gu Feng, who is a drunk monk. And he pretty much, his combat style is drunken boxing. And so he walks around with his cart filled with all kinds of wine. It's, so far, it's been a really good read. There's 10 installations and...
And it's basically ongoing like a webcomic series would be, except it happens to be prose, right?
Right. And so, like, 3 chapters are already out there for you to check out over at superexplosive.com. And I'm enjoying it. It's a fun read. And hopefully I'll have an actual book to to review next time.
I'm actually upset that he got the domain name superexplosive.com because I had an idea that I was going to do with that website. Completely different. You could imagine what I would do with a title. Super Explosive.
That was going to be the name of your sperm bank?
No, it was going to be my live explosive diarrhea cam, superexplosive.com.
I knew it was going to end in poop. I knew it.
I'm just saying, I do it enough, put a cam in there, make a website.
I'm
took
pretty,
it.
I'm pretty
Watch
disgusted.
Brandon poop.
I'm pretty disgusted by that idea, but don't take my word for it.
Well, guys.
Yeah, Cap, what have you been reading?
Since we last did a recording, I finished John D. McDonald's A Deadly Shade of Gold. That book was amazing. And, you know, we talked in depth about the Travis McGee series, which that's part of in the previous episode. And this was like a 2-in-1 deal. Man, by the time when I did that that little report on it in the episode, I had no clue how good it was. It's the best one I've read so far. And it was hard as hell for me to not read the follow-up book immediately after One Fearful Yellow Eye. I haven't cracked it yet. I really want to. But I figured if Nerdy Show Book Club was just going to be anything other than me going through the Travis McGee series and attempting not to spoil things, I should try to mix it up a little bit. So I did. And what I've been reading and I'm in the middle of right now is Mr. Funny Pants, A Memoir of False Starts by Michael Showalter. Now, if you know Michael Showalter's name, it's because he is a comedian and a very good one. He was part of MTV's The State variety comedy show from the early 90s, which was pretty awesome. And then he went on to also be in Stella with David Wayne and Michael Ian Black. You may have seen him in Wet Hot American Summer. He's really great. I love him and he's adorable. So his comedy album, Sandwiches and Cats, is actually my favorite stand-up comedy album, which also has music in it, that I've ever heard. Because I really, like, I have a weird relationship with stand-up in that some people tell good jokes sometimes, but all in all, I don't really like it, and I don't see the point in buying stand-up albums.
Oh, we're going to fight.
Well, but don't worry, we have a whole microsode for that battle.
Luke, don't take his word for it.
Oh, yeah, that's when we're going to fight.
This comedy album was infinitely re-listenable. Maybe it was because there were songs in it as well, but I loved it. I love listening to it over and over and over again. Whereas his compatriot, Michael Ian Black's comedy album, I listened to it a couple times and I was done with it. And
you
I
just alienated a fan of the show, by the way, because he listens all the time.
Well, Michael, I invite you to come over to my house for sandwiches and cats, and we can talk about how Mr. Showalter is underappreciated and
funny,
and that's okay. You know what? That's okay, because I'll just, you know, get some hipster cred here and like him more than you.
But don't take my word for it.
However, Mr. Funny Pants is not particularly good.
Wait, it's not good? But everything I've read out of it is amazing.
That's because I've been showing you all the best parts.
But isn't this book just a collection of everything he's written since he was, like, a young child?
This book is a collection of many things, but it's mostly Michael Showalter desperately trying to write a book. And many, many, many excerpts from it are all about him attempting to write a book, him starting to write a book, his girlfriend interrupting him, showing him what the cat's doing. And while that's funny and a kind of premise, reading it for 50 pages is hard. It really does take at least 50 pages to get into it. And every now and then you'll laugh and something cool happened. It'll tell you about, he has a bit where he reprints an essay he wrote called Taking Ecstasy and Peeing on Myself. And that's great. But he actually has his book, he published his book proposals and his correspondences with his editor, and it's really fucking dry and not particularly funny. And like, but if you love Michael Showalter, you will sit through it because eventually you do get to some good parts and some really unusual things. It's just, I know that he's got a lot of insecurities as a person. He's walked.
You know this personally.
Well, he, like a couple years ago at Pitchfork Music Festival, he was doing a show and he just got really angry at himself and then at his fans and walked off on stage and had some kind of mental breakdown. Like, he's just adorable, but also very neurotic and a little down on himself, I think. And I think he was trying too hard to, like, make a joke out of writing a book that he did the first mistake of, like, a young writer can do in writing is writing about writing. No one fucking wants to read that. It's a mistake.
I thought
you should never do it.
I thought he would think it would be funny if he did that. But I don't think it worked.
But his editor should have, like, said, well, okay, it's okay for, you know, us to, I'm just going to discard all this. You just keep working on it and get to the good stuff. Which does happen as you work your way through it.
Are you going to read us an excerpt?
I'm going to do better than that. I'm going to have him read you an excerpt. Now, but before I do that, there's lots of really good parts. Some of the best parts actually ended up as comedy routines on his album Sandwiches and Cats. I would greatly recommend Sandwiches and Cats over Mr. Funny Pants because it's funnier when he delivers it. However, there's things that can't be done on the comedy album, such as a diagram of him playing Scrabble against an imaginary opponent. With, as you can see here, I'm showing the book to everyone, a board, a picture of a board where he continues to add stuff and shows you how good he is at Scrabble and his tact and everything. For example, his expert deployment of words such as felchings and penis socks. Now, when he changed penis socks to penis soxer, actually, his imaginary opponent contested that. And he said, oh, no, they went to the OED. And you'll find that penis soxer, noun, a penis sock maker. A wearer of penis socks. Also, penis soccer. Playing soccer with your penis. See also pussy soccer. So, you have little gems like that. Also, the opponent played shat. So, Michael said, oh, no. I got you on this. Pre-shat. To my utter shock and dismay, my opponent sees fit to challenge me yet again. This time, the word in question is pre-shat. Once again, the OED is broken out. Pre-shat. Adverb. The stuff that happened right before someone took a shit. Used in a sentence. Bob Shat. Pre-shat, he responded to a backlog of email, chomped on his lady's cooter, and finished that jigsaw puzzle he'd been working on for months of the kitten caught up in a ball of yarn.
See, that's great. That's
it is great, and he's brilliant, and I love him. But he made a horrible mistake with this book. So buy it used, or I don't know, buy it from Michael, and just, you know, and just love him, because he needs to be loved. Because he's brilliant. He just made a bunch of mistakes when he wrote this. So right now, we're going to celebrate the mistakes that Mike Showalter made as a young adult. He's going to give you the full setup, but what I want to do is I want to play an excerpt where he reads something that he wrote when he was in high school.
My parents recently moved from Princeton, New Jersey, where I grew up, to Washington, D.C., to be grandparents near their grandchildren. And they asked me to come home and clean out some boxes of shit before they threw them away. And I found this, which is my high school literary magazine, The Cheshire Cat. And in my senior year, I was the editor-in-chief. So, I'm just saying that I was the editor-in-chief. So, it's kind of a pretty big honor. So, I wanted to just read some of this just because I can't even believe that this is me, but it was me. This is some of the introduction. I thought I'd read you some of my introduction. A youthful voice can be eloquent, musical, impassioned, and gracious. Yet it can also be coarse, angry, vulgar, and acrimonious. Wow. Which tells me I must have been studying for the SAT. In this cat, we don't need to say the whole thing. We all know what we're talking about. We have tried to represent the poems in a generic and simple graphic set. We have done this in emulation of the great poetry journals published by the Beats in the late 1950s. By the way, there is no we, it was just me. I'm talking like I had a whole staff of people running around making deadlines. It was just me. We had to read each piece at least twice before the quality and meaning hit us. That is so impressive, Michael. God, I am really blown away by your diligence. We strongly recommend that you do the same. The cat this year lacks a certain happiness, and for this, we must apologize. It seems that the only grin you'll find in this book is the one that remains when the Cheshire Cat's body has fully disappeared. I'm a writer! Yes! All right, so I wrote this poem and submitted it to the cat, and it got in. Amazingly, it got in. So I wrote this poem, which I thought was like me being a hardcore poet, and I remember reading it to my mother, and I remembered that when I read it to her then, she laughed. Which I was very upset about at the time, but rereading it now, I think I maybe understand a little bit better. The name of the poem is The Apartment Building, and the setting seems to be an urban environment, which is strange. I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. I did go to New York a few times to see Broadway shows, such as Annie and the Tap Dance Kid. The Apartment Building. There is a whore in my apartment building. Her room smells like dirty sex. I was a virgin when I wrote this, by the way. There is a man next door who reads the comics. His idea of a hero is a hand job and a beer. There is a dog in that man's room. His name is Asshole, and he smells like piss. What are you laughing at, Mom? There is also a woman in that man's room. She cleans and gets fucked. I'm spilling my guts out here, Mom. Across the courtyard, a couple lives. He's an actor, she's an actress. They can't find work, so they steal from the market. Suddenly, we're in Marrakesh. They're breaking the law. I smoked a reefer with them. They didn't know shit about fuck. I liked them. I used to be like that. A manuscript lies on a naked mattress that lies in the corner of my two-room apartment. It has a coffee stain on it. The publishers and editors have fucked it to hell. A six-string guitar rests against a chair in my room. It has only three strings. I'm strung out on dope. Next door to me, a young man is writing pamphlets. They are anti-Semitic. But for Christ's sake, that man is a Jew. A guy lies on a flat surface smoking a cigarette. I lie dead in my bathtub. The end.
So we've, you know, we've all been there.
It sounds like something I would write.
We've all written something like that at some point in our lives.
I'm writing like that now.
But it's the awareness. It's the awareness. Anyway, Mr. Funny Pants, it's full of hits and it's also full of misses. And if you read it in order, you will want to quit. But it is, it is worth it. There's some great jokes therein, like the difference between good penis and bad penis.
That
anyway,
was a good one.
But don't take my word for it.
Bad.
That's everybody. That's Nerdy Show Book Club
that's
for the month.
That's been our wacky book club.
But we're not done yet. No.
Nope.
No, there's more to do.
Wait, is there?
Yeah, just a little bit. just a hair of the dog.
No, Brandon, sit back down.
His name is Asshole
down.
And he smells like shit. Piss. Whatever.
Shit piss.
First of all, I want to bring everybody's attention to another cool Kickstarter. This is not book related, but it's cool and it's timely, so I thought I'd mention it.
Is it raise money so Brandon doesn't have to work so he can play Mass Effect 3 and beat it?
No, but you can start that one.
I'm going to.
This is a message sent to us from a band called Deathlehem.
Oh, Deathlehem. Yes.
Hail.
I've heard of that.
Warriors of the Nerdy Show. We are Deathlehem, an RPG, D&D, fantasy, nerd-influenced metal band from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We dress like knights/warriors on stage and play songs about slaying dragons and other epic beasts. We're a DIY metal band and are trying to raise the gold necessary to quest/tour to new realms and play our music for new audiences. And they're only looking for a modest $2,500 to do so. They just gotta repair their steed. And as of this recording, they're practically there at $1,968. They're cool.
Let me just ask a question. Does anyone fail a Kickstarter?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, because I was like, well, this seems easy. Why don't I just do it for, like, I want food. I want money for food Kickstarter.
Well, Kickstarter also has rules on what qualifies for.
Oh, you mean I can't just do anything and be like, I like to eat lobster every day. Yep. I can't have a Kickstarter so I can eat lobster every day. And like the finest duck meats.
You could give it a try.
I'm sure that maybe something like Go Indie or Indiegogo or whatever the hell they call it.
I
like,
want to eat
there's
the
probably
rare
something
African
where you
duck.
Can do this.
Kickstart that.
So we'll have a link to where you can do that, and those guys will actually have a song off their new album featured in the upcoming episode
Circle
of Dungeons
of
and Doritos. Also, I want to talk about all the amazing donors we've got there. As you're listening to this, if this is just released, there are but days left in our first Nerdy Show TV dub support drive, which is where we're going to dub the television show of your choosing.
I think I've done enough.
Brandon and Mike, back in middle school, during the mid-90s, they got together and they did this fan dub thing before it was even popular, before it was even a thing, before there was really even an internet, much of one anyway.
Our school
Juggernaut, bitch?
Our school spent all of their budget money buying this one machine called the Toaster 2000 and some editing equipment with it, and we just did that with VHS tapes.
There's a video up now, the first video of the Triforce Mike archives, where we post random findings of Mike's life and times and hilarious things that we know you probably want to see. And the first thing, Brandon's shaking his head no, but I say yes.
It is. I tried to watch it this, like, today. I watched the first 60 seconds and I was like, done.
Hey,
I'm not finishing it.
Brandon, in your defense, it's got a really rough start, but when it kicks in.
No, I was skipping around.
Hex and I have been quoting it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
It's just a twist of the nipples and away we go.
You must suppress your shame so that we can savor it.
Brandon and Mike dubbed an episode of Masters of the Universe, and it's great, so you should check it out. And
it's
we're
not.
Going to dub something now, in the present, and we're going to do an even better job because we're not in middle school.
Weren't they in the Forgotten Forest?
Wait, what?
I forgot.
Oh, okay. Wait, huh?
You know what? I was trying to watch that again, and it went on for way too fucking long. And I just kept reusing it. We kept reusing it.
That was hilarious.
That's part of the charm.
The funniest thing was the banana man. That's pretty much it.
Well, find out about all of this
if
you watch it.
But I want to give a shout-out to some donors. First of all, we have a donor specifically for D&D. Kyle Sweeney says, Dungeons & Doritos is awesome. Chair is my favorite character, but Jamel is my favorite role player. Aw, yeah. I'm donating because the show is awesome, and I want more. And you'll get more very soon.
Very soon.
And you won't believe your dick.
I don't believe
he doesn't already.
I never listened to that asshole.
Connor Benson donated to bring My Little Pony to an even $200 because he says it's what Mike would have wanted.
Oh, jeez.
Blame the Wizards pitching in to Friendship is Magic in loving memory of Triforce Mike, who is responsible for bronifying him.
Aww.
And Alien Bobs.
Says, Alien Bob Z.
Yeah,
with is how it's pronounced.
Okay.
He's actually a pretty cool dude. I met him when I went to the MC Chris show back in July of 2007.
Oh, well, okay. he says, I want to donate to My Little Pony Friendship is Magic. I'm a big fan of the show, and I think it'll be awesome for you guys to dub it. Hopefully this will win Brohoof. Now, there's many, 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 many shows have been put forth to us to see what we're going to do. But right now, there's a war being waged between My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, Captain N, the Game Master, and Star Trek The Next Generation. Interestingly enough,
wait, live action show.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, Captain N's already dubbed so perfectly. I don't think we could make it any better.
Two words, Megan Man.
Oh.
Hexena.
I could be Picard.
I will destroy you.
So.
But don't take my word for it.
Anti-Luke says, this money goes to support Captain N and the Game Master, and also to get the My Little Pony to bid more before I snipe them. fair warning, guys. A Doombot has requisitioned 3 of your human dollars for the mighty Captain N's crusade. And Nev the Deranged donated to Captain N again. There's been a lot of dual Roosevelting or even triple Rooseveltings going on here. Pretty sweet. He said, this is my last $5 and I'm going on vacation tomorrow, so I better get some backup from the rest of the crew. But then, Viral Demon, who has almost single-handedly been pushing Star Trek The Next Generation ahead himself. He says, I shall start by saying that I enjoy My Little Pony as much as the next person. However, too long has the infestation of ponies gone unchecked. Too long have they been allowed to taint all that is wholesome. This is something that I cannot abide. Rise up, my fellow nerds. Rise up against the infection of our homelands. Rise up against the mutilation of all we hold dear. Stand with me that we might strike down this enemy at its source, the wallet. Viral Demon. P.S. I have nothing against Captain N the Game Master. And also, very recently, as of this recording, Gundam King also donated to My Little Pony. So far, this has been a very, very successful support drive, and we thank you guys so much. It's the only way we can continue to exist and deliver you fine, dick-filled programming such as this.
So now, we're actually going to, because we opened the topic up actually on the Nerdy Show forums as to what format we wanted to do with this episode, and considering the fact that everyone was like, well, do whatever you want, we're kind of doing both. So we're going to be not only reading our own books, but there's also a book. We're going to actually have like an actual book club. We're going to read a book in a month.
Together.
Yeah.
Attemptedly,
yeah. Together.
What if we each read just like a separate chapter? That way, collectively, we've all read the one book.
That's a brilliant idea.
And that way we won't know what's going to happen. We'll have to say.
And it'll make no sense to people that are reading how just the like chapter 37.
Yeah, so.
It's like, wow, I don't even know who these guys are.
Best plan.
Since we spoke to Singularity & Co. about science fiction, I'm picking the first book. And I actually haven't read this book yet. However, I have heard that it's good. It's called Old Man's War by John Scalzi.
That's actually the prequel for No Country for Old Men. I've heard. I don't know. I haven't read it.
They lost the war, and now they have no country.
Anyway, this is the book that we're going to read. It's only like 300 pages, so it's not that long. But basically, the premise of this story is that basically these people have grown up on Earth, and when you turn 65, you sign this declaration that you're going to join the Colonial Defense Force. And when you turn 75, so when you're 65, you sign the paper that says you're going to join the Colonial Defense Force when you turn 75. When you turn 75, you then become part of this army that you then fight basically for humanity against the forces of the galaxy and aliens and et cetera. And basically, if you survive, you will then be able to have a new life on a new colony and basically relive life all over again. So they're taking all these people who have gained experience over their entire lives, as opposed to people who are going to war in their 20s when they barely have lived at all. These people know how to live, they're smarter, they're wiser, and they are now fighting the war.
But so. How, are they in wheelchairs when they're fighting? Do they?
I don't know. There's some sort of twist. I guess they give them. I don't know. They've got to like do some sort of like body thing, or like there's aren't like, you know, like there's some sort of like animatronics or something. I don't know, but there's got to be something. I mean, they're not going to have like, you know, old enfeebled people. I mean, that's fight a,
the twist is they're all dead.
Bicentennial Man.
Yeah. So it's reverse Ender's Game.
It's reverse Ender's Game.
Get off my western front.
Yes.
Does that mean it's very pro-gay?
But if it's as good as Ender's Game, then it's probably good. So I heard it's actually a really, really fun book. So
you can discuss this upcoming book on the Nerdy Show forums. We'll have a link to it on this episode's page. Which leads us to our closing segment, which is an excerpt from a film adaptation. And Luke, I hear you've got something really great picked out for us.
I have something really weird anyway. It is the novelization of the movie Existenz, which is a Cronenberg movie.
I love that movie.
Which means it's bizarre and violent.
Cap, you have not seen this movie yet, right?
I have not. I've seen a
fucking
few Cronenbergs, but
awesome.
Not this one.
I mean, I like it. I don't know if it's good, but I like it. Well, you Man. Know, I like a lot of things that people
but hey,
don't. So.
If you want to see Peter Weller have anal sex with a typewriter, you should see Naked Lunch.
Naked Lunch.
That's L-U-N.
Oh.
Do we need any lead into this Existenz excerpt? Or
I think you do, although I'm not really sure how much it's going to help. the movie itself is about a future where people play video games by plugging into a bioport, and that puts them into a virtual reality. And the story is about – Brandon, you can correct me on the pronunciation of this because I can't remember. Ted Peichel, who is Jude Law in the movie, and
yes,
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
I cannot correct you. Sorry.
You can't? Damn. No. Who is Allegra Geller. Jennifer Jason Leigh plays Allegra Geller, and who is a game designer. And they are inside of her game, Existenz. They have been sent by playing through the plot. They were hinted that they need to go to a Chinese restaurant. And this is what happens there. It's one of the more famous scenes from the movie. Peichel and Geller stared at the dishes. Each one contained an assortment of cooked reptiles and amphibians, frogs with bamboo shoots, deep-fried lizards and sesame seeds, a huge toad set upright amidst stuffed mushrooms with a couple of pieces of corn pushed into his eye sockets, a soup thick with noodles and boiled newts, slices of roast snake with oyster sauce. The Lazy Susan slowly drifted round and round, bearing this bizarre but strangely beautiful feast before them. "My God," Geller said. "You take the words right out of my mouth, Zick." A single saucer-shaped bowl had a compartment to itself, and as it moved on toward Geller, Peichel pointed it out. "Recognize a friend?" he said. Geller took a closer look. It was the two-headed salamander that had ridden on the truck with them from the gas station. Peichel gulped. "Two heads and six legs," he said. "I think I've lost my appetite." The waiter was still hovering beside their table. "Not hungry anymore?" he said. "Great shame, great pity. Mutant reptiles and amphibians provide new and previously unimagined taste sensations. Secret oriental recipes." "Well, yeah," Geller said. "Thanks, but no thanks. No offense, mind." "Shall I clear all this away?" the waiter said. Peichel caught the glimmer of expression that had passed over Geller's face. She was indicating, "This is the special. This is something special. A game character told us to choose it." "No, it looks terrific," Peichel said decisively. He glanced back at Geller, who was nodding slowly. "Thank you, we're happy." "Very good," the waiter replied. "Enjoy." This time he walked away, holding his tray at his side. Peichel looked thoughtfully at the array of animals lying before him, then reached out and selected the toad with the mushrooms. He scooped the toad onto his plate, but returned the mushrooms to the Lazy Susan. With precise movements, he began breaking the toad's muscular limbs off and stripping away the meat. "Peichel, what are you doing?" "I don't know." He'd bitten into the side of the toad, feeling the flesh spreading as his jaw clamped down on it, and the bones of the animal skeleton breaking and separating. His mouth filled with the oily, meaty flavor of meat. "I find it disgusting, but I can't help myself." "That's great," Geller wrinkled her nose in disdain at him. "You can't help yourself." "This isn't my choice," he said with his mouth full. He swallowed, then took another bite. This time he took a leg. After he'd chewed on it a few times, he turned the limb around with his fingers, then stripped the soft meat from the bone by pulling against his teeth. He looked up from what he was doing. He had now dismembered the toad, with many of its largest bones lying on the plate. He set to work on the deep-fried lizard, scraping off the sesame seeds, pulling away the stringy flesh, and laying out the tiny bones on his plate. Everything was stir-fried to perfection. The meat fell neatly from his bones. Peichel's fingers were slobby, and gobbets of melted fat were dripping from the ends. As before, when he'd been sitting by the conveyor belt, his hands carried on their work of their own volition. "I'm interested in what you're doing," Geller said when he seemed to be flagging. Interested? Pykele said, glancing down with horror at what he was doing. You think this is interesting? Yeah, it's fascinating to watch, Geller said. It's a genuine game urge, obviously something your game character, Larry Ashen, was born to do and is good at. Don't fight it. Actually, I did start out by fighting it, but it didn't do me any good, so I'm just rolling with it for the moment. As he spoke, his hands were snapping one of the toad's long thigh bones and twisting a strip of frog sinew around it to form an angled piece. He and Geller watched with horrid fascination as his hands quickly pushed all the various pieces together, slotting them in with shreds of skin, gristle, and sinews to hold them in place, and using the amphibian's own joints to form swivels and cogs and other moving parts. The grotesquely twinned neck bone of the six-legged salamander was the last piece to be put into place. It seated itself neatly with a distinct click, and as Pykele held up the assembly, it was clear that the necks had formed the mechanism of a trigger. He was holding a cadaver gun almost identical to the one that had been used in the assassination attempt at the church.
Oh, that's a good
wow.
End. That yeah. And end.
I oh remember that scene in the movie. It was great.
It was.
I can keep going to when he takes his bridge out, loads it into the gun, and then shoots the Chinese right waiter.
His teeth as bullets.
Oh wow.
Oh,
I can skip forward to the part where he's. Well, it's a lot of description.
That was beautiful. I got to ask though. That was actually like the details were pretty fascinating. Does the movie even compare to that level of like?
No.
It's just bizarre shit happening, as I recall.
Yeah. The movie's but really bizarre.
This is like loving detail. It's kind of great.
That's good. That's what I look for in a film adaptation, really. So that's cool. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining us for this first full-length episode of Nerdy Show Book Club. I guess it's really a double-length debut. Look forward to more of these every month. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Hex.
Bye, I'm Brandon.
Colin.
Luke.
And to take us out is a song. I know that we've been doing a lot of Reading Rainbow, but we won't be doing it as much for all of the episodes. We are just going to do it for this one because we just happen to like Reading Rainbow for this first one. Anyway, the song that's going to take us out is this really great remix that I found by B. Quinn Live, and it's a remix of the Reading Rainbow song, and it's really sweet, so enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Nerdy Show Book Club.
The Nerdy Show Book Club is brought to you by a comic shop, Nerdapalooza, Play and Trade Oviedo, and listeners like yourselves.
If you enjoyed what you heard, support Nerdy Show by telling a friend, picking up some merch at the Nerdy Store, or support us with your hard-earned pounds and receive exclusive perks.
For more episodes of Nerdy Show Book Club, Nerdy Show Dungeons and Doritos, videos, contests, and other nerdy programming, please visit nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to all Nerdy Show podcasts via the iTunes Store.
Follow us on Facebook or Tumblr or on Twitter at Nerdy Show. And get social with other Nerdy Show nerds at nerdyshow.com/forums.
But don't take our word for it.
Da-da-da!
Can we, like, ram that into the ground?
Yes! Yes.
Let's see how many times we can do that in a sentence.
So, I am
Don't
reading.
Don't make the sound, I'm adding the sound, damn it.
But I thought.
God damn, I hate you, Hex.
But
No, Hex! Bad! Just gotta edit it. Colin works so hard to put food on your table, and you make it so difficult for him.
Yes, I do. Colin so much.
First book, wait, hold on, I'm gonna edit this out. Give me just a second.
Say whatever you want since you're editing it.
I hate you so much, Colin.
Exactly. Feel
you're a good fish.
You know, not all of us have a computer in front of us to look things up.
I'm gonna kill you, Colin, but don't take my word for it. But bump.
Could you add that in the end of the episode?
Yes.
So after songs finish playing.
Hi, I'm Colin.
So now we're gonna
hold on.
About
you got to do it again. Hex was talking.
God damn it, Hex! And now my dog is barking. I'm gonna throttle her.
Wait, what?
Oh yeah.
What?
I'm gonna throttle her.
But don't take our word for it.
No, you'll hear the screams.
Hold on.
That is Colin throttling his dog. If you want to turn up the volume on that, I don't know.
The problem is that she just barks at the house across the street. Wow. Because she hates the dog that lives there.
Oh my God.
So she just stares out the window and barks at the house.
And she simmers all day.
Just put her in the oven.
Robbie!
You don't have
Robbie!
To.
She's a wiener dog. She'll keep.
Robbie!
Can we keep this, please? For something? I don't know. I hope you're recording.
Hey!
So I didn't stop.
Shut your dog mouth! Shut your dog wiener mouth!
He's not saying that because she's a wiener dog. He's saying that because, as anything living with Colin is, it has a wiener mouth. It's his fault.
Anyway,
I was only
right
over there for a few hours and I had to brush my teeth.
Oh, I should make a catalog. Do you want? I would make a. I should make a catalog of my samples of my reproductions, and I'll have them assorted, and I'll give you a color swatch. Please use the color swatch to find the best reproductive sample to fit your needs.